This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran with the Today in Parliament podcast for Monday, the 23rd of October, when Theresa May told MPs there'd been progress in the Brexit talks as she reported back from the EU summit.
I am ambitious and positive about Britain's future and these negotiations.
But the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, says it feels like Groundhog Day.
Well, here we are again, after another round of talks, and we're still no clearer.
Also on the programme, as the Speaker gives the go-ahead to an emergency debate on universal credit, peers complain about delays in paying people their money.
Apparently, we heard this morning at a meeting these people are resorting to burglary in order to pay their debts.
But first, the overture to the Prime Minister's traditional post-summit statement came courtesy of a German newspaper. It published a leaked account of Theresa May's meeting with the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, which suggested that she'd begged for help. Mr. Juncker says the story isn't true. When Mrs. May appeared in the Commons, she struck an optimistic note about the Brexit talks.
I am ambitious and positive about Britain's future and these negotiations. If we're going to take a step forward together, it must be on the basis of joint effort and endeavour between the UK and the EU. But I believe that by approaching these negotiations in a constructive way, in a spirit of friendship and cooperation, we can and will deliver the best possible outcome that works for all our people. And that belief was shared by other European leaders.
But the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, said there'd been no real progress, either here or abroad.
I'm now beginning to have feel a very worrying sense of Groundhog Day here. Every time she gives us an update on the progress of negotiations. Only 2 weeks ago, she told this House that her speech in Florence had put momentum into the Article 50 negotiations. And that an agreement on phase one of these talks was within touching distance. Well, here we are again, after another round of talks, and we're still no clearer as to when negotiations on Britain's future with our largest trading partner will actually begin.
And Mr. Corbyn said the biggest battle Theresa May faced was to bring together what he called the warring factions in her cabinet and party.
The Prime Minister is too weak to do anything about it. The outcome of crashing out with no deal to become a deregulated tax haven, the dream of a powerful faction of her backbenches and her frontbenches, would be a nightmare for people's jobs and living standards.
Theresa May insisted there had been progress in the talks.
We haven't reached a final agreement, but it's going to happen. I'd have a degree of confidence that we'll be able to get to the point of sufficient progress by December. After the Florence speech, there is a new momentum. The Florence speech was a step forward, and there should be a positive response to the willingness to work on the interim period, and there has been established a momentum. Now, as it happens, those aren't my words, though the words of Chancellor Merkel, the Taoiseach, the Swedish Prime Minister, the Italian Prime Minister, the Polish Prime Minister and the Danish Prime Minister.
The leader of the SNP at Westminster, Ian Blackford, wanted the Prime Minister to change tack.
Businesses need certainty and we need to know the details of our future trading relationship and any transition deal before the end of the year. It is absolutely critical that we stay in the single market and the customs union. Will the Prime Minister end her government's catastrophic ideological flirtation with a no-deal scenario? Take this off the table and do it today.
Theresa May said Mr. Blackford had raised this issue before.
Full membership of the single market and full membership of the customs union go with the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice and freedom of movement. These are issues which were voted against when people voted to leave the European Union. They would effectively mean that we would remain in the European Union and we are going to leave in March 2019.
The Conservative former Chancellor Kenneth Clark feared a damaging delay unless there was progress in the talks.
The main problem is that other European leaders can see that a noisy minority in the Cabinet and on the backbenchers of her own party have persuaded themselves that no deal at all is completely desirable. And this causes them to doubt whether she's able to produce a clear picture of where she eventually wants to go and whether she's able to produce a majority here for any agreement they have with her.
Another Conservative, Bernard Jenkin, said anyone who thought Theresa May was weak was seriously underestimating her.
Will she stick to her guns, follow through and have confidence that, unfortunately, the only people undermining her from this side are people who are threatening to go into the lobbies with the Labour Party?
But a Liberal Democrat, Tom Brake, called on the Prime Minister to face down people in her own party, who he said were clamouring for a no deal from the safety of their stately homes and inherited wealth.
When is she going to stand up for Remain voters and indeed the Leave voters who do not want the economic catastrophe that the Eurosceptic obsessives on her benches want to inflict upon us?
Theresa May said she was standing up for the British people who'd voted to leave the European Union.
Unlike the Liberal Democrat Party, who want to tell the British people that they got the answer wrong. They didn't. We gave them the choice. They voted and we will deliver it.
The Prime Minister has talked about what she calls an implementation period, what others call a transition period, to give businesses time to adjust to the UK's departure from the European Union. Another Conservative former minister, John Redwood, proposed a different sort of transition.
The best course for a business trading with Europe would be to prepare for a smooth transition to WTO trade terms, which this government can and will guarantee unilaterally, but to expect the Prime Minister to have good luck in bringing back something better.
The WTO is the World Trade Organization. A Labour former minister, Yvette Cooper, quoted the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, who last week told MPs that there would only be a transition phase once the UK had agreed a final trade deal with the European Union.
Could she clarify, is she saying today that if we haven't got a long-term trade deal agreed by this time next year, then there won't be any transition deal at all, and Britain will end up on WTO terms by March of 2019.
Theresa May told MPs the point of an implementation period was to prepare for a future relationship. Now, the most senior civil servant at the Ministry of Justice has told MPs that security and stability in prisons in England and Wales is being affected by current staffing levels. Rob Powell reports.
Last year, 120 people took their own lives in prisons in England and Wales, according to the National Audit Office. That's the highest number on record, and it shocked MPs on the Public Accounts Committee, who are carrying out an inquiry into mental health in prisons. A Labour committee member, Shabana Mahmood, laid out the scale of the problem as she saw it.
Self-harm incidents have increased by 73%. We've had the highest numbers on record taking their own life in prison. That's a pretty damning indictment of mental health within our prison system, especially when you consider 70% of those who took their own life were known to have a mental health condition.
The chief executive of the Prison and Probation Service, Michael Spur, said it was a damning indictment that anybody took their life in prison. He was challenged by Shabana Mahmood over the record of prisons in helping those with mental health problems.
Every time I hear of a death, which I do, every single one, it of course is dreadful.
It's more than dreadful, it's a sign that the system has utterly failed, isn't it, Mr. Spur? Where 70% of these people are known to have had a mental health condition, it is a sign that mental health services in prison have utterly failed.
I think it's, as was said earlier, it's a sign of a whole range of things that aren't working how we would want them to work.
So what are those problems? The Permanent Secretary at the Ministry of Justice, Richard Heaton, said prison staffing levels, which have decreased since 2010, played a part.
The level of staffing has been detrimental to the security and stability and good order in a prison, including self-confidence and ability to be resilient amongst offenders. So it was the case that offenders had a regular human contact with prison officers more often than has been the case in the last 3 years.
Turning back to Michael Spur, the head of the prison service, the committee asked if he had ever raised staffing concerns with the government.
I haven't asked for a direction from ministers. We've tried to deliver the ministerial expectations, the government's expectations, to run with a reduced budget, as many departments were required to do. When we introduced the staffing changes, we tried to do those in a way that would continue to deliver adequate and proper services to all of our prisoners.
Mr Spur said that the prison service had been given more money and an extra 2,500 officers were being recruited. One focus will be putting into action guidance from the 2015 Harris Review, which looked at self-inflicted deaths among young people in prison.
His main recommendation to government about that was actually reinvigorating and providing a caseworker for each of the young people who they could relate to. In putting an additional 2,500 staff into prisons, we've taken the Lord Harris model that he looked at and are looking to introduce that across the system with key workers for every individual prisoner.
A rise in the use of psychoactive drugs in prisons was also flagged as a possible cause of mental health issues, along with a need for better sharing of prisoner medical records, something the committee was assured was going to happen. Asked how confident he was on their ability to respond to the issues raised, the Ministry of Justice's Permanent Secretary Richard Heaton was cautiously optimistic.
If it was simply to meet a need that was standing still, I'd be totally confident, because I genuinely think the steps we've got in place in terms of getting drugs out and training staff and increasing staff will meet the demand. And my only worry is that the demand out there gets worse and worse. So things are happening in society which we see reflecting in prisons. So we will struggle to keep up with a worsening demand and a worsening cohort coming into prison. But I'm confident that we will see the back of the really horrific numbers we saw last year on suicides, which is perhaps the number that alarms us most. I'm confident that we're going to crack that.
Other witnesses were similarly measured, with one saying he was confident in the authorities' response, but adding that the scale of the challenge was very high.
Rob Powell. Now, last week, Labour won a symbolic victory after MPs backed its call to put the rollout of universal credit on hold. Conservatives were under orders to abstain, and the result wasn't binding on ministers. But afterwards, the Commons Speaker, John Bercow, told the government it should respond to the vote on changes to the welfare system. What's more, Mr Bercow hinted that he'd look favourably on a request for an emergency debate. Well, today, he got his chance.
I seek leave to propose that the House should debate a specific and important matter that should have urgent consideration, namely that this House has considered the matter of the government's response to the decision of the House on pausing rollout of universal credit full service.
That was Labour's Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, Debbie Abrahams, who said in spite of the decisive vote, there'd been no word from the government.
Worse still, in business questions, the day after the government's resounding defeat, the Leader of the House used a change to government policy on the phone lines of universal credit made before the vote last week as a justification for refusing to inform the House as to when we might expect a further statement on this matter.
She said the opposition had 20 chances to choose the subjects being debated in the Commons.
All previous governments have recognised that the failure to carry the House against an opposition motion is a serious rebuke to the government's policy on an issue that has been treated accordingly. This is even more important when the House has spoken on an issue that could dramatically affect the lives of up to 7 million people. Yeah. And they are the people who will be subject to the flawed universal credit programme.
Well, the Speaker approved Labour's request, and the emergency debate will take place in the Commons tomorrow, and it'll last for 3 hours. Still to come, why has the Speaker run out of patience?
In short, let's get on with it.
We'll find out in a few minutes. But first, MPs have held their first debate on government plans to get more people using electric and driverless cars. The Automated and Electric Vehicles Bill cleared its first parliamentary hurdle when it was given a second reading earlier this evening. During the debate, it was suggested that housing developers should be required to install charging points on roads near newly built homes as part of plans to encourage more people to drive electric cars. Peter Snowden reports.
The government wants the UK to become a world leader in new car technologies. The Transport Minister, John Hayes, said he was optimistic about the potential of electric and driverless cars.
Just as Henry Ford proved a century ago, there are huge chances for innovators who are able to realise the revolutionary potential of new automotive technologies. Exports of low emission vehicles are already worth $2.5 billion to our economy. And it's estimated that the market for autonomous vehicles could be worth $28 billion by 2035.
The pace of change, he said, would expand car ownership.
It's an opportunity to give access to cars to those that have never had them. The profoundly disabled, the elderly, the infirm, partially sighted and blind people who haven't been able to drive, they have relied on others to drive them, will suddenly have the opportunity of car ownership, which they've been denied them by nature of their disability or their need for so long.
Mr. Hayes admitted that upfront costs and battery reliability often deter people from buying electric cars. A combination of subsidies and improving technology would allay these doubts, he said. But one of the bill's main aims was to improve access to charging points.
These powers will establish common technical standards and greater interoperability. They will increase the amount of consumer information on the location and availability of charge points, and they will accelerate the rollout of electric vehicle infrastructure at key locations, as I said, like motorway service areas and large fuel stations.
Last month, the Labour MP Helen Goodman bought an electric car. She wanted the government to go further.
I was very struck by the fact that to have your own charging point, you need off-street parking. Now, obviously, that's not possible for anyone who has a flat or a terraced house. So will ministers please consider, in all new housing development, changing the planning rules to require charging points to be put into new roads, as well as at railway stations and in all publicly owned car parks?
Mr. Hayes said he would be happy to talk to colleagues at the Department for Communities and Local Government about making changes to the planning system. Carl Turner, the Shadow Transport Minister, broadly welcomed the measures in the bill. He said more needed to be done to improve infrastructure.
There are currently nearly 12,000 charging points for electric vehicles in the UK, but at present there are multiple charging point operators, each with their own plugs, software, customer charges, billing systems and payment methods. They're also unevenly distributed, which is a point made by my honourable friend. There are more charging points available, for example, in the Orkney Islands than in Blackpool, Grimsby and my own fair city of Hull combined.
He warned ministers against any divergence with the rest of the European Union over the new technology.
We must absolutely ensure that regulation and standards are maintained after Brexit. This is essential if the UK is to be the vehicle manufacturer's location of choice for the development, testing and deployment of automated and electric vehicles.
The former minister and chairman of the all-party parliamentary group on historic vehicles, Sir Greg Knight, was worried that driving a car may become a thing of the past.
Some academics are saying that when automated vehicles become commonplace, the government will seek to ban people from driving cars themselves, or at the very least will introduce a policy which severely restricts motorists' driving. Will he confirm that that is not government policy today, and that he has no intention of making that government policy in the future?
The minister said that it would be intolerable to imagine that people would be banned from driving any car in the future, let alone classic cars.
Peter Snowden. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that following the election, the select committees are up and running, holding inquiries and questioning expert witnesses, but not all of them. And the Conservative, who chairs the Health Committee, Dr. Sarah Wollaston, was interested in one in particular.
It's now more than 4 months since the general election, but still the liaison committee is unable to formally meet to carry out its functions on behalf of this House. Could you, Mr. Speaker, assist us? Because I'm afraid repeated representations from across the House from select committee chairs are not yet making a difference in ensuring that all select committees are properly constituted.
The Speaker, John Bercow, said she had a point, and the liaison committee, which is made up of the chairs of the other select committees, wasn't alone.
The same situation, I think, applies to the European Scrutiny Committee and also to another committee which is not a select committee but which is a committee of Parliament and a very important committee at that, namely the Intelligence and Security Committee. These committees are there to scrutinise the executive branch.
Mr. Burko said he'd discussed the problem with the Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, and he issued a warning.
It would obviously be most unfortunate if it were necessary for members to keep raising points of order day after day after day after day before these committees were established.
Well, the subject came up again later, when the Conservative chair of the Defence Committee, Julian Lewis, complained that the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy hadn't been set up either. Here's the Speaker again.
This is now, frankly, an embarrassment, and it needs to be sorted, preferably this week.
A Conservative, Bill Wiggin, who chairs the Committee of Selection, said he thought there would be some good news soon, but he told Mr. Burko there'd been a hold-up on names. The Speaker wasn't impressed.
In short, let's get on with it.
Now, there's been a lot of speculation recently about the future of the Royal Marines. When the Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon, faced MPs, he was asked to give a guarantee that there would be absolutely no cuts. Alicia McCarthy has the details.
The Shadow Defence Secretary, Nia Griffiths, began with a dig at her opposite number, Sir Michael Fallon, suggesting he had his eye on one of the government's top jobs.
We've heard there's a growing Tory rebellion over the next month's budget, with half the Cabinet determined to sack the Chancellor because they're convinced they could do a better job themselves. There's even speculation about the loyal Defence Secretary. He may be about to launch his own offensive on number 11.
A comment that provoked both groans and laughter from MPs. Moving on to what she said were more serious matters, she turned to the defence budget. Earlier in the session, Sir Michael Fallon had told MPs the defence budget had risen from 34 to 36 billion and would reach almost 40 billion by 2020. But Nia Griffiths said the government's chaotic mismanagement had led to gaping holes in the MOD's budget.
So can the Defence Secretary say categorically that there will be absolutely no cuts to the Royal Marines?
Yeah.
Sir Michael Fallon had previously refused to rule out cuts. Thumping his folder on the dispatch box, he chose his words carefully, giving an upbeat assessment.
The Royal Marines are part of the Royal Navy. With the latest astute submarine Audacious launching back in the spring, the steel cut on the first of our new frigates, HMS Glasgow, in July, the sailing of Queen Elizabeth, the naming of Prince of Wales and HMS Forth and HMS Medway. Nobody should be in any doubt that this year has seen the Royal Navy growing in power and in numbers.
A Labour MP, Geoff Smith, thought there was another problem when it came to armed forces budgets.
The latest figures show that the army is running at 6% under the number of personnel needed, with a gap growing. How understaffed do we need to be before the Secretary of State will put some pressure on the Chancellor to lift the 1% pay cap in order to boost recruitment?
The Minister said the army was currently 95% manned, but Nia Griffiths reckoned the government could find money for a pay rise if it changed its priorities.
Stop thinking about that 2.5 billion tax giveaway they're giving to the big companies and the wealthy, and now actually commit to freeing up the Armed Forces Pay Review Body so that they're not constrained by the 1% pay cap and allow them to give a proper pay rise to our Armed Forces personnel.
Answering this time, the Defence Minister, Tobias Elwood.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure where the Honourable Lady has been, but there is now that flexibility. It's been removed. There is no longer that pressure to remain in that 1%.
A Conservative, Keith Simpson, raised a different subject, asking about comments by the Foreign Office Minister, Rory Stewart. In a BBC interview, Mr. Stewart said that the only way to deal with British IS fighters in Syria was, in almost every case, to kill them, adding that they believed in an extremely hateful doctrine, had moved away from any allegiance to Britain and posed a threat to security. So, Keith Simpson asked the Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon...
Is that now government policy?
My honourable friend has made clear, and I've made clear, that those who've travelled to fight with Daesh in either Iraq and Syria will have been committing a criminal offence.
Sir Michael said the government had to make sure that if those involved did return, they didn't pose a threat to national security.
They have made their choice. They have chosen to fight for an organisation that uses terror and the murder of civilians as a modus operandi.
But Labour's Dan Jarvis, a former army officer, wanted reassurance.
Whilst agreeing with what the Secretary of State said about Daesh, he will know that one of the things that separates them from us is that we are bound by the rule of law and specifically by rules of engagement. Can the Secretary of State take the opportunity today to confirm that our conduct will always be bound by the Geneva Convention?
The Geneva Convention are the international rules that apply in times of armed conflict, and Sir Michael replied that the UK would absolutely comply with them.
Alicia McCarthy. Now, as we heard earlier, MPs will hold an emergency debate on the government's handling of its welfare changes tomorrow afternoon. But there were concerns in the Lords as well about the way universal credit has been introduced. An independent or crossbench peer, Lady Meacher, predicted that the rollout would lead to an unprecedented level of personal debt.
These are not the fault of the individuals. These result from the fact they have to wait, on average, 7 to 8 weeks for the first payment when they're new claimants. They then get a payment for 4 weeks. It is not possible for them to survive. And also, of course, we know their benefits are reduced by bedroom tax and all the other bits. And then debt withdrawals. Apparently, we heard this morning at a meeting, these people are resorting to burglary in order to pay their debts.
A government minister, Lord Bates, said the Work and Pensions Secretary was looking at the details of the scheme.
No need for people to engage in any of those types of activities because help is there. Help is there in the shape of the advance, which over 50% of people now take advantage for, which can be based on that element. But we need to remember that universal credit was brought in with cross-party support because of the very purpose that what it would actually do is it would stop the perverse incentives, which meant that under the previous benefit system, people could actually work more hours and actually be worse off to being in a system where people would always be better off if they work.
Well, earlier, one of the most colourful characters in the Upper House took the oath for the last time.
I swear by Almighty God that I will give true and faithful allegiance to Her Majesty's Queen and Government. Amen.
Lady Trumpington, a Conservative, celebrated her 95th birthday today. She will retire from the House of Lords tomorrow. During World War II, she was a land girl on Lloyd George's farm and then a codebreaker at Bletchley Park. After a local government career in Cambridge, representing the village of Trumpington, Jean Barker was made a life peer in 1980. She served as a minister under both Margaret Thatcher and John Major. Today, there were cheers as Lady Trumpington shook hands with the Lord Speaker. And that brings us to the closing headlines from Westminster. The Prime Minister struck an optimistic note about the Brexit talks when she gave MPs an update following last week's EU summit. Theresa May said she was ambitious and positive about the future. But the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, said the talks were at a standstill and he accused Theresa May of being too weak to deal with splits in her party. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Georgina Pattinson. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.